Wei Si Hong, Wei Si Hong. Li Qiajian didn't want to lie, so he just repeated the name. Little Xi, Little Xi. She's from Beijing, offered Fang Qiaodi. From Beijing. Li Qiajian went on repeating as though he was thinking about it. From Beijing, come to Henan from Beijing. Who's in charge here? Asked Fang Qiaodi impatiently. God is in charge here, said Li Qiajian. Don't talk nonsense, said Fang Qiaodi. Forget it, let's go, said Old Chen, pulling Fang Qiaodi away. Li Qiajian turned around, closed the front gate very purposefully, and walked off with Gao Shengchan towards the township. The shepherd has a responsibility to protect his sheep, he thought. Those two, he said to Gao Shengchan, might be public security informers, so I didn't want to tell them anything, but I didn't lie either. Gao Shengchen had not said a word, but he had a different opinion of Chen and Fang. He felt that old Chen and little Xi had a special relationship, a male-female relationship, and so, even though he knew where she was, he didn't want to help them find her. He knew that they would come back, and he felt a little uneasy about his refusal to talk to them. He had to handle things in the order of their importance, and the most important of important things he had to concentrate on now was to prevent his fellowship from being drawn into a protest. If old Chen had not received Jiang Du's text message, he would not have known for certain that little Xi was there, and he might have had his confidence shaken by this encounter. Now that they had located the church, he knew for certain that little Xi was there somewhere. Those two fellows were simply unwilling to tell them the truth. He told Fang Qiaodi to stay there at the church and watch for little Xi to come out while he himself returned to the township center, found an internet cafe, and tried to communicate with Mai Zi Busi online. Old Chen and Fang Qiaodi didn't know that Gao Shengchen and Li Tiejun were fully aware that little Xi was at that very moment inside the church attending a Bible reading class. She would not leave the church that day, but would eat lunch there, and in the afternoon she would go to the internet and surf the virtual world, or perhaps use her Mai Zi Busi web name to write a blog on the peasants' rights defense movement. She might even receive an answering post accusing her of being a son of a bitch who turned the truth upside down. Dinner in the village at 5 p.m., participation in the fellowship witness meeting at 6:30, and at 8 p.m., a discussion with the most enthusiastic brothers and sisters of the plans for the final meeting on the Jiang Family Village land rights protest. Little Xi felt that her life was richly rewarding. The population of the Warm Springs Township was less than 100,000, but there were quite a few internet cafes. As Gao Shengchen and Li Tiejun were going into the county head's office in the county government building on Yellow River Road, Old Chen was entering an internet cafe that had just opened for business. He was extremely excited when he found Mai Zi Busi's blog and comments. Little Xi was so far away and yet so close. But 4 hours passed before Old Chen posted his first comment. At first, he thought he would play it cool, so he wrote a post saying that he was traveling with a friend in Henan and visiting Jiazhou to buy Chinese medicines. He disingenuously asked her if she was still in Beijing and said he'd like to meet up with her. He probably thought that she would respond to this by saying what a coincidence that she was also in Jiazhou, and why didn't he meet her for dinner at the Yiwan Hotel? Fortunately, he didn't send this message. Who was he going to fool? It was too ridiculous. So he wrote a different message, apologizing for when Wenlan had suddenly appeared and saying he hoped he could see little Xi. To such a message, however, she would probably just respond that it was no big deal, no need to apologize, never mind, see you sometime when we have the time. He still would not get to see her. Given her assumptions about his relationship with Wenlan, she probably would not want to be alone with old Chen again. He would have to tell her the honest truth, that he'd come to Jiazhou in Wen County deliberately to see her, that he wanted to see her because he wanted to be with her. He decided it was time to declare his love. If he could do so openly, Everything else could be talked through in more detail later. Some 20 years earlier, he'd fallen in love with Wen Lan, and she had hurt him badly. For many years after that, he didn't dare have any feelings for anyone else. To open his heart now to little C would certainly take a great deal of courage. Old Chun sat there blankly for 2 hours before he finally wrote a nearly 5,000-word post entitled, "A Letter to Mai Zibu Shi from Someone Who Is Not a Stranger," in which he poured out his thoughts and feelings in fast-flowing prose. The first line of Chun's letter was, "When you open this letter, I will be at the modern Fuxi Internet Cafe on Yellow River Road in Warm Springs Township, Wen County, Jiazhou City." Next, he told her that after he'd met her at the Five Flavors restaurant in Wudaogou in the 1990s, he had always loved her. He'd never expressed himself at the time because she had so many male friends around her all the time, and then later she had an English boyfriend. Still later, because he'd been hurt so badly, he was afraid to ever try to have another serious relationship. Old Chun described how he and Wen Lan had met, become engaged, how she'd dumped him, and how, 20 years later, he ran into her by chance as a French crystal chandelier. Most importantly, he told her how very recently he had lost his heart to another woman whom he had not seen in a long time, how he had learned to get in touch with her, how he had waited for her reply, how they had met again, how he had lost contact with her again because of Miss Wen's barging in, how he had looked her up on the internet, how he had followed a possibly unreliable lead and come to Henan, and how he had put the pieces of the puzzle together and learnt that she was in Warm Springs, and that woman was Little C. Now he only hoped that she would give him a chance, would communicate with him, would give him time in Henan, in Beijing, or anywhere else to prove his love. He'd also brought along a friend who could help restore her memory. Old Chun even told Little C of his thoughts about death on the drive to Henan, that if he were to die in an accident, he hoped it would be while holding her hand and facing their last seconds of life together. Or if he were to die a natural death, he hoped that she would be sitting at his bedside watching over him. He wanted to live out his last years with her. Old Chun wanted to post the letter as a comment on Little C's blog, but it was much too long. He had to divide it into several smaller sections and post each one separately while leaving a notice that he had a blog on the Sina network where the entire letter could be read as a whole. After Old Chun had finished pouring his heart out, he sat very calmly in front of the computer and checked every few minutes to see if there was any answer. Shortly after lunch, Little C had indeed gone online and very soon noticed Old Chun's post, after which she went to his Sina blog and read the entire letter. It made her whole body feel totally paralyzed. For the past 2 years, she'd wanted so badly to find someone she could really communicate and share her feelings with, but every time she'd been disappointed. After meeting Old Chun again, she had fantasized that he was different from other men, but in the end, or so she thought, she had become another woman. As she was despairing more and more, she discovered the church fellowship. She didn't really believe in religion, but what she'd found was a large extended family. Then, when the Jiang Family Village Rights Protection Movement had come along, it made her feel useful. She never imagined that at this point Old Chun would come into her life again to declare undying love. Little Xi sat blankly in front of her computer for over an hour. She knew that at another computer, someone else was also sitting there blankly. Finally, she posted an answer. "I am no longer the Little Xi that you knew. I like the present you even more," was Old Chun's immediate answer. "I suffer from clinical depression," she wrote. "I know. I'll take care of you," he fired back. "My body is decrepit beyond repair. I'm proof of your beauty. I'm not sure I want a relationship. I'll wait patiently until you decide. I'm sure I don't have time for a relationship, Dilsi wrote. I can wait as long as you want, in Henan or anywhere else, Ouchen answered. They went back and forth like this until after 5 in the afternoon, when Little C sent a last post. I have to go offline. Give me some time to think things over, then we'll talk again. Little C went to help the fellowship prepare dinner, and Ouchen closed down the computer. He decided to go to the church and look for her. What the two of them didn't know was that during the entire afternoon, many netizens were following their posts with bated breath. After they left their computers, the netizens' comments on their dialogue took over. Some said it was very moving, some said it was schmaltzy, some said it was cute, and some even said it was disgusting. Taiwanese netizens said they had to admire this romantic auntie and uncle, while mainland netizens said that no matter how you looked at it, it was amazing how they kept going. On the whole, though, these netizens reached a pretty unified verdict. Stop faffing around, Little C. Make up with Ouchen and everything will be okay. At around 6, the brothers and sisters of the Warm Springs Fellowship finished their evening meal and came to the church with their hearts full of thanksgiving to wait for the witness meeting to begin. Gao Shengchun and Li Tiezhen had also just emerged from the county government building and decided to say a simple prayer then and there on the street to thank the Lord for his grace. That morning at the meeting with the young and able county head Yang, Gao Shengchun had said what needed to be said as though with the Lord's help, stating his case thoroughly and in a dignified manner. Although the county head had remained silent throughout, Gao Shengchun was confident that Yang had listened to him attentively. As for how the official would evaluate the pros and cons of this case and what the fate of the church might be, Gao Shengchun left that in God's hands. When they left the morning meeting, the head secretary had come to find them and advised them not to go too far and to be ready to be called back. This was a good sign. The two of them waited in a small restaurant near the government building. Let's say a prayer, Gao Shengchun said, taking Li Tiezhen's hand. County head Yang conferred with his advisers and then called the township leader and the business's representative to an immediate meeting. The meeting lasted until after 5. Then Yang summoned Gao Shengchun and Li Tiezhen to his office. Yang thought like a bureaucrat, but he was also pretty smart. He knew that Gao Shengchun was trying to force his hand, but he also knew that for the sake of his future career, he had to back down somewhat. He informed Gao Shengchun and Li Tiezhen the Jiang Family Village land requisition program was definitely going forward as planned, but with the good offices of the county government, every family would receive increased compensation for their land. Furthermore, due to a revision in the amount of land required, the land occupied by the homes of the church members was no longer within the scope of the plan. In this way, the business interest group had been made to give up some of their large potential profits, and the township leaders who had failed to stop corruption had been thoroughly reprimanded. The government's credit with the people had been maintained, and an organized mass protest had been prevented. As County Head Yang formally escorted Gao Shengchun and Li Tiezhen to his office door, he reflected that when promoted to provincial level, he would no longer have to deal with the schemes of these church people. Gao Shengchun, aware that he had achieved his goal, offered up a few words of praise. Yang was a genuine mother and father to the people, he said. And Yang replied that it was the people who were his mother and father, and it was his duty as a mere public servant to serve them. In this fashion, with a mutual acknowledgement of their insincerity, they bid each other a cool goodbye. Walking back to the church, Gao Shengchun felt he had accomplished something very good. The rights of his parishioners had been restored, and a direct confrontation between the church and the government had been avoided. His only worry was in facing those of his flock who'd been so enthusiastically preparing to mount a protest, especially Little C. Nevertheless, Kaohsiung-chan never wavered as to what was important and what was not. Meanwhile, old Chun and Fan Chao-di were sitting in the chapel among the worshippers and looking all around for little Xi. Xi was in the kitchen, and while helping to prepare refreshments, she was just managing to calm herself after the emotional turmoil of the afternoon, when she looked out and spotted old Chun among the faithful. Her heart immediately started to race again. She hid behind the door, not daring to enter the chapel. Just then, she heard the sound of the Kainan hymn, "What Am I?" and felt deeply moved. Kaohsiung-chun and Li Tie-jin entered the chapel, and Gao instructed Li to ask the congregation to settle down because they had something to tell them. Then Kaohsiung-chun announced the new decision taken by the government on the Jiang family village land issue. This decision in favor of the brothers and sisters of their fellowship, he said, was an example of God's grace and demonstrated that God had heard everyone's prayer. Finally, he led them all in giving thanks, shouting, "Thanks be to the Lord!" Some of the faithful were moved to tears of joy. Many of them, however, were there precisely to witness such moving reactions. When they'd settled down again, old Chun stood up and proclaimed in a loud voice, "Everybody, I have something I want to say to you." Li Tie-jin tried to stop him, but Kaohsiung-chun indicated to Li to let him speak. Kaohsiung-chun knew that such events could not be prevented by force, but had to be handed over to the Lord for his disposition. "Fellow countrymen," said old Chun, "I am on the lookout for someone. Her name is Wei Xihong, also known as Little Xi." The people stared quietly at the stranger, but did not respond. "I am a friend of hers," added old Chun. Still, no response. "If you know where she is," old Chun continued, "please tell me. Please let me see her because I love her very much and I can't live without her. I hope you can tell me if she is here or not." The entire fellowship of the good people of Henan looked back intently at old Chun. Old Chun waited with rising emotion, fighting back his tears. All he received in return was a deep silence. Finally, he calmed himself down, nodded slightly to them to indicate that he would not persist. He turned and walked slowly towards the door.
"Old Chun!"
Little Xi burst out of the kitchen. Old Chun stopped, looked round.
"Old Chun," Little Xi said calmly, "let's go back to Beijing."
Epilogue. A Very Long Night, or A Warning About China's 21st Century Age of Ascendancy. The life of man, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Thomas Hobbes, The Leviathan. Look at the ants crawling round and round, marshalling their troops, the bees roiling in confused chaos, brewing their honey, and hordes of buzzing flies fighting over the blood. Ma Ji Yan, Autumn Thoughts on the Night Voyage. All is for the best in the best of all possible worlds. Dr. Pangloss in Voltaire's Candide. Idealism, Chinese Style. Hundreds of millions of Chinese lived through an age that witnessed a storm of idealism and were baptized in that flood of idealism. Even though later on their ideals turned to nightmares and disillusionment, and an entire generation of people lost their ideals, still they didn't abandon idealism. Fang Chao-di and Little Xi had grown up in that turbulent era. They themselves were probably not even aware of the fact that no matter how much the times and the environment had changed, they still retained the strong character of idealism they had learnt in their youth. One ideal vanished, and even though it was not immediately replaced by another one, ready-made, they would continue to search for a worthy one. They were not realists. They were not opportunists, careerists, hedonists, appeasers, nihilists, or escapists. They were representatives of that extremely difficult to describe Chinese style of idealism. Even though the People's Republic of China has been established for over 60 years, China remains a great nation of idealists. The population of China is so large that even though the percentage of idealists is small, if they were placed in some other country, their actual number would be overwhelming. Just think of all those people currently languishing in prison or under government surveillance: human rights lawyers, political dissidents, promoters of a democratic constitution, leaders of non-governmental civil organizations, promoters of independent political parties, public intellectuals, whistleblowers, and missionaries of the underground churches. No doubt all of them are hopelessly incorrigible idealists that the People's Republic of China version 2.0 can never cure. No society can afford to be without idealists, especially not contemporary China. Of course, contemporary China is fertile soil for realists, opportunists, careerists, hedonists, appeasers, nihilists, and escapists. In this age of prosperity with 90% freedom, many people are like pigs in clover. They found their golden opportunity and are living exceptionally well. In this age, if you're lucky enough to be born into a hereditary party and government aristocracy family and your roots are a deep crimson red, then all the heartier congratulations to you. In the future, you will have a tremendous competitive advantage and many business resources will be looking to you to cooperate with them. If China has an aristocracy, you are that aristocracy. From the point of view of a Chinese Communist Party that intends to govern China forever, you are one of them and the party trusts you. At this point, before our plot takes a dramatic turn and before we bid farewell to our heroes, let me first build somewhat on the story of three of our characters whose roots are as deeply red as red can be: Wei Guo, Wen Lan, and Ban Chuntao. It goes without saying that they're all riding the wave of China's age of prosperity. They're big winners under the Chinese social, political, and economic model. I'm not going to spend time relating to you how they catapulted into prominence like leaping dragons and bounding tigers. I just want to tell you, I predict that these three are flourishing now and they will continue to be in the ascendant. A rich, many splendid life awaits them. Is this, perhaps, China's destiny? Let us return to Fang Chaodi and Little C. That the two of them felt like old friends the minute they met and regretted they had not met earlier was wholly to be expected. They had such a common language and so many similar life experiences. Even more importantly, for over 2 years the two of them had been searching, as if possessed, for like-minded individuals. And finally they could prove that my way is not a solitary one. When Old Chen introduced them, they saw at once that they were indeed like-minded. They then seriously attempted to analyze why, when everyone around them experienced an ineffable feeling of happiness and a mild form of euphoria, they always remained clear-headed and aware. Fang Chaodi said that the American Food and Drug Administration had issued a warning in 2009 that some common medicines given to treat asthma, such as Montelukast, Zafirlukast and Xylitone, could cause depression, anxiety, insomnia and even suicidal tendencies. Maybe the asthma medicines prescribed in China had the same side effects. Due to their drug intake, Chinese asthma sufferers were much less prone to euphoric states than others, and thus also more clear-headed and aware. Little Xi, however, said that this was pretty strange, because the antidepressant medicines she took should have had the opposite effect. These medicines stimulated the brain to secrete more monoamines like serotonin and norepinephrine, which caused people to become excited. So people like her on antidepressants should not have been able so easily to notice that other people were high. She had read a report stating that mood-altering antidepressants had already surpassed blood pressure medicines as the most commonly used prescription drugs in America. When over-the-counter drugs were also considered, antidepressants were now the number one most used drugs in America. Many Americans who were not really suffering from clinical depression, but who didn't feel good, whose spirits were low, or who were unhappy in their work, resorted to some kind of antidepressant. Little C wondered if perhaps many Chinese people were also taking antidepressants on their own initiative and feeling high all day. Fang Qiaodi corrected her by reminding her that no matter how prevalent antidepressants were in China, there was no way that everyone was taking them. The phenomenon they needed to explain was why almost the entire nation was experiencing a feeling of a high, while clear-headed and sober people were so few. During the entire trip from Henan to Beijing, the two of them exchanged stories of the things they'd experienced during the past 2 years. Old Chen could only listen until Fang Qiaodi drove his dust-covered Cherokee into the village where Zhang Du and Miao Miao lived. When Zhang Du heard Little Xi's voice, he thought it sounded familiar. Little Xi also felt that she had seen Zhang Du before, but could not quite remember where. That night, Zhang Du and Miao Miao put up a tent in their yard and gave their bedroom to Little Xi, while Fang Qiaodi put up a folding cot in his room for Old Chen to sleep on. Little Xi had already said she wanted to be with Old Chen, but she needed a little time to adjust, a hint that she didn't want to move in and live with him straight away. Fang Qiaodi said Little Xi could stay in Miao Miao's room for the time being, and when the weather was a little cooler, he and Zhang Du could build on another room for her. Old Chen speculated that if, for the moment, Little Xi didn't want to move in with him, that didn't mean she wanted to live for a long time in the countryside. He didn't, however, push her to decide straight away. He thought that by staying for a while with Miao Miao and Zhang Du, and having Fang Qiaodi to talk to, she would avoid the prying eyes of the government, and this was not a bad idea at all. It was very difficult for an outsider like Old Chen to anticipate what sort of a powerful fighting spirit might be generated when people like Fang Qiaodi and Little Xi, who'd been without a comrade to share her Chinese-style idealism for such a long time, came together. Not to mention with a strong young man like Zhang Du as their ally. After a detailed discussion with Fang Qiaodi and Zhang Du, Little Xi gradually began to regain her memory of the first day of that lost month. It was on the 8th day of the first lunar month, after the spring festival holiday had ended, when people started to return to work, but the television, papers and internet reports all carried the same news. The global economy had entered a new period of crisis. "We all suddenly felt we were facing imminent disaster," they recalled. A roller coaster ride of varying accounts appeared on the internet and mobile phones. In the beginning, everybody cursed America for its runaway inflation and for the overnight 30% drop in the value of the dollar that caused the Chinese people to lose a vast amount of their hard-earned foreign exchange reserves. Then we heard that the southern factories had closed down, the peasant workers could not return to the cities to work, and the Chinese economy was really going to collapse this time. Next came the news that the price of gold had risen to $2,000 an ounce, that the Shanghai and Shenzhen stock markets had completely shut down to avoid further losses, and that martial law had already been declared in Xinjiang and Tibet. The atmosphere in Beijing changed instantly. Office workers headed for home, causing a huge traffic snarl-up, while gossip of all kinds continued to circulate. By the afternoon, the people's response was to start stocking up on food and everyday essentials. Zhang Du described how at that point, he and Miao Miao had gone out immediately to buy dog and cat food, and a good thing too, because after it ran out, there was none available for over a month. In any system, especially an economic system, if everyone's activity is duplicated and multiplied so that there is only one sort of feedback without any opposing message, that system will surely collapse, they concluded. Stocking up on food and essentials worked like that. At first, everyone was afraid of prices rocketing, so they bought everything, cleaned out the shelves and stockpiled stuff at home. When everyone did the same thing, the supply was soon insufficient to meet the demand, and then genuine panic buying set in. It was equally strange that while Beijing's official central television was broadcasting news reports of social chaos all around the world, no one came on, as they usually did, to reassure the public that supplies of food and other essentials would be sufficient to meet people's needs. Fang Chaodi said the government could not possibly have been so slow to act. He and Little Xi at the time both believed that there was something suspicious about the situation. There had to be another reason for the government's inaction. Little Xi remembered that she had phoned around all that afternoon to various intellectuals and media people she knew to see if they had any ideas about what to do, or if they wanted to get together to discuss the situation. Everyone was too busy stocking up on food and other supplies for their own families, and nobody had the time to talk about formulating a response. In the late afternoon, Little Xi and Big Sister Song decided to close the restaurant and go home. On the way home, they noticed how few people and cars there were on the streets, just as after the 4th of June 1989 and during the 2003 SARS epidemic. They were carrying food back from the restaurant when someone rode by on a bicycle and grabbed a big turnip right out of Big Sister Song's hands. Rumours circulated on the internet, television and mobile networks, while police car, ambulance and fire truck sirens could be heard howling outside. But no night curfew was announced, so people in the courtyard organised their own mutual defence squad. Little Xi could still not remember the events of the second day. The effort of recalling gave her a headache and made her feel sick. She only knew that one night when she came home, she had shouted, "They're going to crack down again!" She could not sleep all night and kept mumbling it to herself. Early the next morning, she went out into the courtyard to curse the Communist Party, the government, and the neighbours, and shouted that the law courts were all bullshit. She fainted soon after, and when she woke up, she was in a mental hospital. This was what her mother told her after she was discharged, but strangely enough, after a while, even Big Sister Song could no longer remember any of it. Fang Chaodi said he was in Guangdong at the time, and the state of anarchy lasted for 7 days. For the first six, everybody was already terribly frightened because they'd heard there was great chaos in various other regions. Fang Chaodi had been in those areas, however, and they had not really been that chaotic. But he was given the third degree because he was an outsider. On the 12th of the month, he slipped away to the border area where Guangdong, Jiangxi and Hunan came together and stayed in a peasant's house. Later on, he heard that the 14th had been the worst day because a riot, with looting and arson, had broken out. Many local residents tried to escape by going to the county seat where they heard things were safer. Lots of people received the same message over and over. "I've just had this news from the highest authorities. The country is in chaos. The government has lost control. Take care of yourselves, everybody." Is China going to collapse? This was a question many had been asking for years. Will the Chinese government lose control? Fang Chaodi had travelled all over the country, in the western regions, the central plains and elsewhere, and he'd always told everyone, "Relax, there's no way for the disaffected to join forces. China will always experience small disturbances, but never complete chaos. The disturbances will be local in nature and will never spread to the whole country." During those 7 days, however, the people felt like they were in purgatory. Every day was too long. And by the seventh day, they had put up with as much as they could stand and were about to go to pieces. As you can imagine, various criminal elements were keen to do their worst, so the population felt terrorized. There was almost mass hysteria. It looked as if total anarchy would soon break out, a fight of neighbor against neighbor to protect one's life and property. People had just one hope in their minds: that the machinery of state would soon go into action. Fang Chaodi had also begun to think by then that if the situation didn't improve soon, China really would collapse into total chaos. On the eighth day of the Troubles, the 15th of the first lunar month, a small detachment of the People's Liberation Army entered the township where he was and received an enthusiastic welcome from the populace. Zheng Du said, this was the way he had heard it too. On the 15th day of the first lunar month, 2 years earlier, when the People's Liberation Army entered Beijing to restore order, the people of Beijing turned out in full force on the streets to welcome them. That afternoon, the Public Security Bureau, the The armed police and the People's Liberation Army issued a joint communique that a crackdown had begun. Zhengdu didn't have a Beijing residence permit and didn't dare go out on the streets. Instead, he hid out at home for 3 weeks. Little Xi wondered whether she herself had actually gone out to welcome the People's Liberation Army troops. Then she really must have lost her marbles. Maybe it was because she heard a crackdown was coming that she lost control of herself and went berserk that afternoon. Fang Qiaodi told Little Xi that once the crackdown started, any suspicious person would have been locked up. He himself was turned in by a peasant and taken to the local public security bureau where he was almost sentenced to death. Luckily for him, there had been a young female judge who stood her ground against her colleagues and insisted that they handle his case on the basis of the law and the constitution. She had saved his life. Little Xi wept profusely that night as she recalled in sorrow everything that she'd been through. The crackdown of 1983, the People's Liberation Army tanks rolling into Beijing in 1989 to suppress the students, had frightened her to death and left her with an immense feeling of frustration that called into question her life choices and her abilities. But now she felt she could sense her original vitality returning. From her online disputes with those middle-aged angry youths where she expressed her own opinions about the government, to defending peasants' land rights with the fellowship, through to listening to Fang Qiaodi tell his story of a young female judge who argued strongly for right and justice, Little Xi felt that she was growing stronger and stronger, that she had finally found her true self again. Whose idealism is the most radical, Fang Qiaodi's or Little Xi's? The answer is Little Xi's. What do we mean by radical? The original classical meaning of radical is root, from the Latin radix, to find the essential root of something. Fang Qiaodi has a plain and simple sense of justice, of working on behalf of heaven's way. Added to his naturally stubborn character, his sense of justice spurs him on to search tirelessly for that missing month. Little C's sense of justice is more abstract, more philosophical. The socialist and internationalist education that she received as a child engraved the bright words equality, justice, friendship and mutual aid firmly on her heart. She really didn't understand the hypocrisy of the Chinese Communist Party. In college, she studied the Roman and Napoleonic law that was taught again after the Cultural Revolution ended. During the 1980s and 1990s, she was baptized in the tide of Enlightenment values such as reason, liberty, democracy, truth, and human rights. Both Romanticism and rationalism made deep impressions on her, and she adopted the idealism of a typical, contemporary, westernized Chinese intellectual. Although her idealism is not without its blind spots and intrinsic limitations, due to all of the above, we know that Little Xi is more radical, and hers is a radicalism that will remain steadfastly loyal to the end. Think about it. What was it that sustained Little Xi for the past few years as she underwent such great suffering and social marginalization? We've already read how she was the female host of an intellectual salon in the 1980s and 1990s. During those years, she mainly listened to the views of prominent personalities of the time and very rarely offered her own opinions. In the last 2 years, though, when the intellectuals appeased the government or were harmonized away, Little Xi rose up in opposition and threw herself into solitary combat. Without a backward glance, she argued strongly for truth and justice, expressing her opinions on the internet. This process forced her to clarify her own thoughts and use rational arguments to state her case in the face of her opponents, who used emotive language, rhetoric, populism, and even violence. She's become increasingly dispassionate and clear-headed. We should not, therefore, make the mistake of thinking that Little Xi is still the weak legal clerk secretary with a sense of justice that she used to be, or a petofi club salon woman, or an unemployed and helpless mother who cannot even control her own son, or a crazy woman who scurries around like a frightened animal. She is already an obscure but genuine public intellectual, though she would never consider herself as such. This is her armor, her vocation, the air she breathes to live, her loveliness and her repulsiveness. She is willing to endure the greatest suffering, hardship, and personal humiliation as long as it brings her closer to the truth. To live or die together. After staying at Myama's house for a couple of days, at the weekend, Old Chen went back to his Happiness Village No. 2 apartment, changed into a set of clean clothes, and went to Starbucks for a latte grande. On Sunday evening, he attended another one of Jiang Ling's old movie screenings. In recent months, only Jiang Ling, He Dongsheng, and Old Chen had been present at these monthly soirees. To tell the truth, these screenings had become events that Jiang Ling organized just in order to accommodate his cousin, the party and national leader, He Dongsheng. Old Chen was simply a guest necessary to keep He Dongsheng company. If Old Chen didn't go, and there were only the two cousins there, it would be rather embarrassing and hard to continue the screenings. For friendship's sake, Old Chen felt he had a responsibility to attend. He explained patiently to Little Xi and Fang Chaodi why he had to be there, and besides, he said, he had become rather addicted to hearing He Dongsheng give his long, monthly lecture apropos the subject of the film. The film they saw that night was Setting Sun Street from 1981, and the wine they drank was more of the 1989 Chateau Lafite. Jiang Lin had instructed a broker to buy 5 cases of this at auction, so for the next few months they would probably be drinking this same vintage. Of course, Old Chen could hardly complain about drinking 1989 Chateau Lafite every month. The film had been shot in a district around the Buddhist Setting Sun Temple on Liangguan Road on the edge of Beijing's Second Ring Road. The film depicted the lives of a number of ordinary people at the start of the reforms and openness era, and from it you could see the new market economy model. One of the characters depicted was a con man pretending to be from Hong Kong, who wore a showy white suit, spoke a fake Cantonese, bragged and extorted money and sex. Young Chen Peixi played an unemployed youth, euphemistically called a youth waiting for work, who raised pigeons and whose favourite phrase was, "Bye-bye, y'all." When the film had finished, He Dongsheng recited a poem by the Yuan dynasty poet Ma Jiyuan. "Look at the ants crawling round and round, marshalling their troops, the bees roiling in confused chaos, brewing their honey, and hordes of buzzing flies fighting over the blood." Then he went on. "The market economy can spur on people's initiative and enthusiasm, but sometimes it looks chaotic, like it isn't working. The key thing is to have a firm grasp of its regular rhythms. The government should not manage anything, but it has to manage everything. It taxed the mental capacity of 2 generations with us going back and forth and round, working ourselves to death. Even now, I break out in a cold sweat dreaming about it at night." Old Chen almost laughed out loud. He was thinking that He Dongsheng would not even have gone to bed at midnight, and even if he did, he would have insomnia. How could he dream back to an earlier time? After that brief reverie, Old Chen pretended to listen to He Dongsheng's long-winded lecture about the many political confrontations that had occurred during the 30-plus years of reforms and openness. Old Chen was really thinking about Little Xi, whom he had not seen for a mere 2 days. At the end of his speech, He Dongsheng said, "There will always be flies, but we can't stop eating just because there are flies around." Then he went quiet, and the 3 of them just drank their wine in silence as usual until midnight. He Dongsheng went to the toilet and then asked Old Chen if he wanted to lift home. Old Chen was afraid that He Dongsheng would want to cruise the streets again and keep him up too late, so he politely declined. He Dongsheng left and Old Chen stayed behind. Jiang Lin told him he was going to London to attend a wine auction and to buy himself a few cases of Burgundy. Old Chen was happy to see that Jiang Lin was over Wen Lan. When he took his leave, Jiang Lin said, "Bye-bye, you all," in the manner of the film actor Chen Peixi. It was an early summer evening, and Old Chen was feeling particularly good. His feeling of happiness was back again. As he started to walk home, he thought to himself that before he went back to Miao Miao's house, he had to remember to pack up and take along his big bag of cholesterol-lowering oatmeal. He came out of Jiang Ling's apartment complex, turned a corner, and had just reached the street when he was startled by a big black SUV pulling up next to him. He thought he recognized He Dongshen's car, but he noticed that it was Fang Chaodi driving. Little Xi and Zheng Du were in the back seat, and the three of them were shouting at him to get in.
"Hurry!"
they yelled. "Whose car is this?" Old Chen asked as he opened the passenger door.
"Just get in," they said.
Old Chen hadn't fully got his mind around what was going on before he was already in the car and it was taking off down the street. "Isn't this He Dongshen's car?" he asked after a while. "How come?" Old Chen looked around at the back seat and saw that Little Xi and Zheng Du had a man pinned down on the floor under their feet. He stared at them, speechless.
"Old Chen, calm down," said Little Xi. "Everything's been arranged. There's nothing to worry about."
"He's fine," said Zheng Du. "I use the best brand of chloroform. Puppies and kittens get no side effects from it. The worst he might have is a headache for a couple of hours."
"He won't wake up for at least 2 hours," chimed in Fang Chaodi as he drove along. "No matter how loudly we speak, he won't be able to hear a thing. I've tried this chloroform myself. It puts you out completely for over 2 hours, and it's perfectly reliable." "Have you all gone crazy?" shouted Old Chen, glancing in terror at He Dongshen.
"We won't hurt him," said Little Xi. "We just want to ask him some questions."
"After that, we'll set him free," said Fang Chaodi.
"You really are crazy," said Old Chen in dismay. "We're fucked, really fucked."
"Shit," said Fang Chaodi suddenly. "Trouble up ahead." Old Chen turned back to look through the windscreen. Traffic police were conducting vehicle checks.
"Now we're really fucked," he said, paralyzed in his seat.
"Everybody, sit up straight," said Fang Chaodi. He looked like he was going to ram the roadblock. Just then, Old Chen saw hurrying towards them that same fat traffic cop who'd stopped He Dongshen a couple of months before. He grabbed Fang Chaodi's arm and said, "Don't try anything stupid. Slow down." As Old Chen expected, the portly traffic cop prevented the other officers from stopping their car and just waved them through the checkpoint. "Okay, now drive slowly," Old Chen instructed Fang Chaodi, "and gradually increase your speed." As the SUV passed through the checkpoint, Old Chen made eye contact with the fat cop and gave him an army salute. He finally relaxed, and the three others heaved a sigh of relief.
"That was close," said Zheng Du.
"A miracle," said Fang Chaodi.
Old Chen signaled to Zheng Du to move over a bit and then let his front seat recline at a 45-degree angle. He turned on his side and reached over to search in He Dongsheng's pockets for the anti-surveillance device. He took it out and pressed the button. A few seconds later, the three little green lights came on. "Good," he said. "Nobody is following us or listening in on us." He handed Zheng Du the device and told him to put it back in the left inside pocket of He Dongsheng's suit. Old Chen sat back exhausted in a sad silence.
"Old Chen," said Little Xi, "you mustn't blame us. Old Fang and I debated for a long time and then decided that we had to question someone who has inside information. Otherwise, no matter how hard we try, we'll never be able to figure out the truth about that lost month. There's no way we can resign ourselves to not knowing what really happened."
"We figured," continued Fang Chaodi, "that in China, where all information is controlled by the government, only a party and national leader would have knowledge of the entire internal situation."
"But how could we meet a national leader?"
"That was when we thought about this Professor He you told us about. Then we decided to find him and get him to explain things to us. But we figured he wouldn't want to talk to us, so we had to take a few risks. Anyway, We believe that our national leaders have a responsibility to tell the common people the truth. Unless we scare them a bit, they will never talk. Old Chen remained silent.
Old Fang and I, said Little Si, were afraid that you wouldn't agree, so we didn't include you in our plans. You can honestly say that you're not a part of this kidnap. If you want to pull out now, we won't try to stop you. We can let you out to take a taxi back, and it will be just like all this never happened. You won't know anything about it.
Ou Chen sighed loudly. Of course, continued Fang Chaodi, we all hope that you'll stay with us and hear Professor He's explanations. We've already set everything up. We're going to use remote video equipment in two separate rooms to tape our questions and his answers. He'll never see our faces, and our voices will be electronically modified. He'll never know who we are. Just now in the parking lot, explained Zhang Du, we all wore masks. We can be quite certain that before he was unconscious, Professor He didn't see our faces. How can you be so stupid? Old Chen finally spoke. You have a witness, said Fang Chaodi, that you were not in on it. When we grabbed him, you were still inside with your friend Jian Ling. We've thought of everything. That's not the most important point, said Old Chen. They didn't understand what he meant. The most important point, he continued, is that very few people know about He Dongshen coming to this monthly film screening. Maybe only Jiang Ling and I do, and the secretary. At most, three people besides He Dongshen know about it. I'm sure to be investigated. I can't get out of it, and I'm sure to be the prime suspect. Even if they assume I wasn't one of the actual planners, when they ask me who I've seen lately, I will naturally give them your names and you will be investigated. Now that you've let me know what you're up to, even before they torture me, I'll be so scared I'll probably squeal. This time, we're totally fucked. Three of them suddenly understood. They went quiet for a long time. Old Chen, Little Si finally broke the silence. I'm sorry we got you into this. It was my idea to grab a national leader and ask him what has really been going on. I was so angry, and now I've got everyone in trouble. I can't let you take the responsibility, said Fang Chaodi. This was all my rotten idea, and I owe you all an apology. Let's find a place to stop the car, said Zhang Du. Put Professor He in the driver's seat, get out and go home like nothing ever happened. Professor He will wake up alone in less than 2 hours from now.
Will he be able to remember what happened before he was unconscious? Asked Ou Chen.
When I grabbed him, said Zhang Du, and put the chloroform rag over his mouth, he only struggled for 6 or 7 seconds before he passed out.
When he wakes up, Ou Chen said dejectedly, he'll have a headache and he'll remember those 6 or 7 seconds. Then he'll definitely phone his secretary and activate the whole security system. They'll check all the CCTV street monitoring tapes and probably call that fat traffic cop for corroboration. Then they'll start investigating me. The result being that I'll be scared shitless and give you all up. This time, we're definitely fucked. They all went quiet again. They were probably each thinking about various possible ways out of this dilemma.
We could kill him, said Fang Chaodi after a while, and everybody gasped, but Fang went on. I could never kill someone to keep him quiet. I'll do everything myself and take all the blame. You all get out of the car. I'll drive down south, contact the government and ask for a big ransom to divert attention from all of you. You can all get out of the car here, okay? Zhang Du, leave the chloroform with me.
How can we do that? Asked Little Si. It's just my one rotten life, said Fang Chaodi. So why not?
What do you say, Ou Chen?
Old Fang, said Ou Chen. This may be disappointing for you to hear, but even if you make it down south and kill yourself before they catch you,
It still won't solve the problem that only a few people knew of He Dongsheng's movements this evening. They'll definitely investigate me, and I'm 100% certain that I'm a coward and scared of pain. As soon as they start on me, I'll confess everything. Even if you make your sacrifice, it won't prevent this inevitable outcome. We'll still be fucked. Ou Chen turned to Zhang Du. What is your safest estimation of how long we have before he wakes up?
The earliest he could wake up would be in 90 minutes, but I could give him some more chloroform, answered Zhang Du with a glance at his cell phone.
Now that things have gone this far, said Ou Chen, there's no point hurrying. We still have some time, so let me see if I can think of something. In the car, as Ou Chen was mulling over various possible escape strategies, he remembered that in his detective novel, 13 Months, he had used a plot twist that he called Live or Die Together. It got him thinking. When they reached Miao Miao's house, he sat down by himself in a corner and didn't say a word. He closed his eyes and saw his wasted life pass before him, his ruined reputation, his happiness drifting away in a mist, the impermanence of life, and himself in prison and on the execution ground. His hands were trembling and he broke out in a cold sweat, but he pulled himself back to reality and tried over and over again to calculate the possible implications of using his live or die together plot twist. In theory, it could just work, but in practice he didn't have much confidence. He kept struggling back and forth in his mind until he was exhausted. He knew time was not on his side. The moment to make a final decision was upon him, and four lives hung in the balance. Zhang Du and Fang Chaodi had already carried He Dongsheng into the house, tied him up in a big armchair that had been bolted to the floor in one of the two rooms. A digital camera was set up so that they could watch their prisoner from the other room to check when he woke up. Little Xi pulled a chair over in front of Ou Chen and took his hand in hers. Being close to her made him feel calm. He had been considering one particular element of the situation. His live or die together plot might not have any effect on an ordinary bureaucrat, but it might just have a chance with He Dongsheng. This was because He Dongsheng was no ordinary, unimaginative official. He Dongsheng was intelligent enough and his mind was nimble enough to understand how to play this game. So Ou Chen came to his final decision to gamble everything on his idea. Ou Chen, said Fang Chaodi, walking over with a tense expression on his face, whatever you decide, we'll all do what you tell us. I have a premonition that we can turn this situation to our advantage.
Is he coming round? Asked Ou Chen.
Sure is, answered Fang. Is the camera connected properly to the computer and ready to broadcast on the internet? Asked Ou Chen.
A digital camera, an MP3 player, a desktop computer and a laptop are all linked together to broadband, said Zhang Du, settling down beside the TV monitor. Also, three cell phones with cameras are all aimed at Professor He and are all ready to broadcast simultaneously.
Perfect. You all have a lot of questions you want to ask him, right? They nodded. Good, said Ou Chen. We've come this far, so in for a penny, in for a pound. When he comes to, don't utter a sound. Listen to what I say. When I tell you to start talking, you can ask him all the questions you can think of, okay?
Okay, we'll follow your lead.
Even if I tell you to do something you don't want to do, you must still do it. Are we agreed on that?
Agreed.
Now, let's go in the other room and question him, said Ou Chen.
But we don't need to. We can question him from this room, said Fang Chaodi.
We can't communicate properly that way, said Ou Chen. It has to be face to face.
I'll go in and question him for you, offered Fang Chaodi.
I have to do it myself, insisted Ou Chen.
Then you better put on a mask.
Old Fang, will it make any difference if I wear a mask or not? The moment you kidnapped He Dongsheng, I was already in on it with all of you, past the point of no return.
I'm going in there now. You can all choose to remain in this room and keep well out of it if you want.
Old Chun took the lead and walked into the other room. Then little Xi pulled off her mask and followed. Fang Chaodi and Zhang Du went in together behind her. He Dongsheng was an extremely analytical person.